There's no question that Lord Chaitanya wanted a limited amount to be delivered. He wanted everyone to go back to home, back to Godhead. And this possibility is there. Just like one time in Prabhupada's room, Jamuna, she was kind of asking Prabhupada in a very nice way. She said to Srila Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, is it true that if we just chant 16 rounds a day and follow the four regular principles, that we'll go back to home, back to Godhead in this lifetime? And Prabhupada became quiet. He obviously, he could see that Prabhupada was actually hurt. And he said to her, it was like Prabhupada was looking at her to say, how could you doubt me? So Prabhupada says, do you think I would cheat you? Prabhupada said, I guarantee you that if you chant 16 rounds a day and follow the four regulated principles, you will go back to home, back to Godhead in this lifetime. Guaranteed. Now you may say, how is that possible? Yes, that may be so. Because one can say I'm very unqualified, and that's true. But then again, there's no qualification for going back to home, back to Godhead. You see? Why? Because there's no material qualification. And all you've got is material qualification. Isn't it? So in that sense, there's no qualification. If you study properly, you will find that there's actually no qualification for going back to Godhead. So, how can you say you're qualified to go back to home, back to Godhead? Because there's no qualification, because it's not a material thing. One does not qualify oneself. One qualifies oneself for getting the mercy of Krishna. Therefore, Prabhupada said, do something, Krishna will recognize. Don't try to see Krishna. Don't try to push your way back to Godhead or force an entry or sneak in the back. Not possible. But do something that Krishna will recognize that here is my devotee. Now, there are many examples of in the Vedas and Puranas and Bhagavatam of many devotees who went back to Godhead in very, very many different ways. One particular story I like was that there was a thief. And this is a true story. He was actually at a Bhagavatam recital. So in the recital, this particular reciter, he was always glorifying Krishna, but always telling about how many beautiful jewels Krishna had. And how he looked very elegant and very nice. And these jewels were priceless. So this thief wasn't very intelligent. But he was very attracted to jewels. So he was very interested in this particular thing. So in the course of the discussion, I think basically he asked the reciter, he said, where is this Krishna staying? Because he thought that he's talking about someone. So he thought, I better go and see this guy. He sounds pretty wealthy. So he said, where is he staying? So he said, oh, he stays in Vrindavan, in the forest. So that thief became very attracted. He said, oh, really? Vrindavan in the forest. So this thief went to Vrindavan. And actually, he was so convinced that Krishna was there that he didn't at all, for one moment, ever think that Krishna wasn't there. So he spent a lot of time looking for Krishna. And Krishna appeared to him. He came from within the forest. He met Lord Krishna. So Krishna, he appeared as a young coward boy. So the thief thought, wow, this is amazing. Here's a boy. That's even better because, you know, when you want to rob a boy, there's not much resistance. So he said to Krishna, he said, oh, you have very nice jewels. And Krishna said, yes, my mother gave me them. So he said, well, can I take these jewels from you? He said, oh no, my mother will be annoyed if you take. So because of the sweetness of the exchange between the thief and the boy, Krishna, he actually forgot that he had come to rob Krishna. And he actually became a great devotee of Krishna. So the point is that Prabhupada makes this point that Krishna can reciprocate with anyone. You understand? It's not a question that Krishna is looking for some sort of material thing. No. Krishna is looking for that intense desire. You see, that intense desire is the currency or the price by which we can get Krishna. We must be have an intensity, this greed, if you like, lola, this greed. One must have a great intensity to want Krishna. But the thing you should understand is that Krishna is always in a playful mood. So therefore, he doesn't like his devotees to approach him in a awe and reverence. You see? He cannot really approach Vrindavan in awe and reverence. Because Krishna is a boy, and his friends are all young boys, children, and Balaram also. So he wants to play, just like that thief. He somehow Krishna revealed himself to the thief. Because why? Because Krishna wanted to. So this is the point, is that in order to approach Krishna, one has to make friends with one of Krishna's intimate associates. That is how one actually approaches the Supreme Personality of God. Because there's no qualification. There's no actual, what you can say it, anything that you've done that can qualify you for going back to home, back to God. But what does Krishna do? He sends down these intimate devotees as guru. They are called Bhagavat Guru, Mahabhagavat Gurus. They're not ordinary personalities of the material world. They are practically, in so many ways, Nitya Siddhi, but they are eternally liberated souls. They're not to be looked at material. They're not a material thing. They don't exist within our conception of time and space. They may appear at certain times and certain places, but they're always there. They are always there in Lord Gauranga's family. They are always there. And they are the containers, if you like. They contain the ocean of mercy. They are carrying Krishna. And I had practical experience of this with Srila Prabhupada. He was sitting on the Vyasa sign. I always remember this very profoundly because it was a very profound moment. And Prabhupada was looking at Radha Landaneshwara in great ecstasy. When you saw Prabhupada relating to the deities, it was not conceivable. It was very hard to describe. It was very, very intimate. So Prabhupada was looking there with great love. And then he was looking at the devotees, and he was looking at the deities, and then he was looking at the devotees. And then Prabhupada said, I have captured Krishna, and I am keeping you here. And he put his hand to his heart. I am keeping him here for you. Now you come and take. And I could understand, anyway, immediately at that point, that something profoundly spiritual was going on at that particular moment, because Prabhupada was revealing his actual position. And that is that Srila Prabhupada has captured Krishna. What does it mean to capture Krishna? How can you capture the Supreme Personality of Godhead? You see, this is very difficult for people to understand. Because in order for you to give something, you must have it. Isn't it? So unless you capture Krishna, how can you give him to anyone? You understand? So therefore, Srila Prabhupada was revealing that he had actually captured Krishna. conquered Krishna by his love. And he said, I'm holding it here. I'm holding it. Now, how can you hold God? How can you hold on to God? But Prabhupada was showing it. I'm holding it. Now Prabhupada said, now you come and take it. So therefore, we should understand very carefully that this Krishna conscious movement is going on directly on the Srila Prabhupada and directly by Prabhupada's mercy. This movement is the manifestation of Prabhupada's mercy. It is the manifestation of the kindness of Srila Prabhupada because he wanted to deliver everyone. We saw that in his personal life. And we also saw that this was not something related to time and circumstance because Prabhupada spoke always of the future. He always spoke of his plans that this Sankirtan movement, this ISKCON movement, would go all over the world, that the whole world would be inundated. Prabhupada came to fulfill the direct prophecy of Lord Chaitanya, that my name will be known in every town and village of the world, and Prabhupada came to fulfill that. So it's also interesting because when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was leaving the planet, not leaving the planet, but sending his ambassadors, if you like, or his preachers to the Western world, we must note that actually these particular preachers came at a later part in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's life, and neither were they very successful. Prabhupada said actually that they weren't able to fulfill the desire of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. But Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that now that wonderful time has come, that joyful time has come when the message of Rupa Sanatana, Lord Chaitanya, will go to the Western world. And this attempt to spread this message in the Western world is the humble offering of this servant of Krishna. You see, so the humble offering. In other words, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had a desire to deliver the whole world. And that was his offering to Lord Chaitanya. Srila Prabhupada was practically the only disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur to understand the heart of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. You see? So that means Prabhupada was the most confidential, the most intimate disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And therefore, he was able to fulfill that mission. Therefore, Prabhupada used to say to us, my Guru Maharaj has sent you. He told us that one time. He said, he sent all of you. My Guru Maharaj is very kind. He has sent all of you all over the world so that you will assist me in this humble service to my Guru Maharaj. So Srila Prabhupada was aware that all of the arrangements that were going on was his Guru Maharaj. Just like I was sitting in Bombay in Prabhupada's room. So, just to show you also many of the qualities of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada was extremely humble and extremely respectful, even to his own disciples, even though he also could be like a lion. But there's also another side of Prabhupada which was very, very intimate. So I was sitting with Prabhupada, so Prabhupada said, Tribhuvanath Prabhu. And I was shocked, you know, to be called Prabhu by Prabhupada. How can you be called Prabhupada by your spiritual master? But still, Prabhupada said, could you put on the light? So I put on the light for Prabhupada. And then we sat there. So I wanted to glorify Prabhupada, and here was a nice chance. So I started glorifying him. I said, Srila Prabhupada, what you have done, no other acharya has done, no other messenger of Krishna has been able to do. You have come from aristocratic family, you have come from very high, I think I use the word in the sense that you have come from such a great lineage and you have come to such a horrible place, Western country full of malechas and low-class people. And in such a short time, you have been able to spread this Krishna consciousness all over the world. And then I said also, pointing to Prabhupada's books, I said, you have done all these books as well in such a short time. It's completely bewildering how you have done this, Srila Prabhupada. And it's difficult to explain because Prabhupada was listening, but it's like Prabhupada was also so deep that Prabhupada could always tell your heart. You never, there's many occasions where devotees used to try and speak to Prabhupada, but you spoke to Prabhupada with your heart. Prabhupada knew your heart. So he knew I genuinely was speaking from the heart. And then Prabhupada, he became like, it was almost like a child. He became very, very soft and extremely, deeply humble. Prabhupada said, actually, I have done nothing. He said, whatever you are seeing, he said, it is my Guru Maharaj. He has done everything. So Prabhupada never thought for one minute that anything he did was actually him. He always understood that it was his Guru Maharaj. But he actually realized that. There's a difference between thinking that and realizing that. So in the higher level, one can understand that Srila Prabhupada was the manifestation of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's humble offering at the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And we are, or we inherit the legacy of also becoming part of Srila Prabhupada's humble offering at the lotus feet of his Guru Maharaj. So therefore there's a great responsibility, and that is the meaning of parampara. That Prabhupada said one time, Guru means heavy. The Guru, the spiritual master, means heavy. And when you take shelter of a spiritual master, you take on the weight of the Guru. You see, what is the weight of that Guru? What is the weight of the Guru is that the Guru, the spiritual master, is representing the mercy of Radharani. So therefore, that is very heavy. Radharani's mercy is very heavy. Lord Chaitanya's mercy is very heavy. And therefore, when we take shelter of such personalities, then we also have to carry that great weight. But at the same time, of course, because we are being supported by the internal energy, therefore everything is possible. There is all possibility. There is all victory to the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya. So we saw in Srila Prabhupada's personal life that even though Prabhupada, just like you're seeing Prabhupada sitting behind his desk, that's basically how I always saw Prabhupada. Prabhupada was always completely relaxed, transcendental, and always talking about Krishna, always chanting. Sometimes Prabhupada would sit in his room hours on end chanting bhajans, and in the evening he would give darshan. In the morning he would give instructions to all the managers and different things. So practically speaking, all that Prabhupada did really was just glorify Krishna. We saw that practically. He was always glorifying Krishna. Even when Prabhupada was talking, you could see him chanting. He used to chant while he talked. Always. I used to watch him because I could see it. But Prabhupada would be chanting japa while talking. Now you can't understand that, but there are examples in our line also. Prabhupada, I noticed anyway, maybe others noticed, I don't know, but Prabhupada was always chanting, always chanting. When Prabhupada got sick and they took him to hospital, he had to have some minor operation or whatever. Because of heart or some problem. So the doctor, they were complaining to the devotees, this man is always praying. He never stops. We can't stop him praying. You ask him to stop. He never, practically speaking, he's always, always chanting. And Gaga Muni, what happened was that, this is a true story, Gaga Muni told me directly, not long after it happened actually, but Prabhupada, had to be, what do you call it, put on anesthetic. So they gave proper injection, and it didn't work. So the doctor couldn't figure it out, because normally, I don't know if you've ever had an injection for anesthesia, but you go out pretty quick. So they gave another injection, and still nothing happened. And the doctor called Gaga Mooney over, and he said, you know, we've given him enough anesthesia to knock out an elephant. And he said, nothing's happening. We're completely bewildered. What should we do? Give him another injection? We've given him more dosage than we've ever given him. So Gaga Mooney was bewildered. He said, well, I'll ask. Let me ask Prabhupada why, what's happening. So Prabhupada said, there's a problem. So Gaga Mooney said, yes, Prabhupada, they want you to go unconscious. And Prabhupada said, why they don't tell me? So then Prabhupada went unconscious. So the point is that there are so many incidents in Srila Prabhupada's life that one could understand. Anyway, that Srila Prabhupada was always simply glorifying Krishna. Simple method. That one should simply glorify Krishna. That is all Krishna consciousness is about. It's simply about glorifying Krishna. Such a simple thing. We try to live, just like one time Prabhupada said, this Krishna consciousness is so simple, you will miss it. He used to say that on occasion. So simple. Everyone thinks, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Everything except glorify Krishna. But actually, all Krishna is looking for is our love. And the glorification should be done with love. That's all that Krishna consciousness is glorifying Krishna out of love. Because the nature of the spiritual world, what is the nature of the spiritual world? Is that it is inhabited by beings, by living entities who only want to glorify Krishna. And what is the nature of the material world? It is inhabited by living beings who only want to glorify themselves. Slight difference, isn't it? Huh? So therefore, every endeavor of the material world is to glorify oneself, either in the form of gaining some material thing, showing off that thing, getting some money, getting prestige, getting position, getting adoration, getting glory, getting fame, getting power, always getting, gaining something. Gaining something what? So that one can glorify his material position. So Krishna consciousness simply means glorifying Krishna. And by glorifying Krishna, then one frees himself from all false consciousness, all false identification with his body. So that therefore, one gradually, it is not that so quickly, because we're very, very attached to our materialistic, egotistic position. But gradually that this glorification of Krishna goes on, one gradually purifies the heart, melts the heart. Krishna melts the heart. Madan, Mohan. What is the meaning of Mo? Anybody know? Mohan. Mo. We say Mo. Attachment. Exactly. Mohan. One who can attach, one can attract and attach the hearts of everyone. So in the material world, it is signified by attachment. The reason we're here is attachment, isn't it? That's why we're still here. Just like one time Prabhupada was saying, as the devotee was saying to Prabhupada on a walk, that Prabhupada, what was the exact word? The devotee was explaining that because of Maya, one is in a certain situation. But Prabhupada explained, in the material world, it is just like you are embracing a tree And then you are saying to the tree, let me go, let me go. See? Let me go. But you are holding on very tight to the tree, but you're telling the tree, let me go, you tree. Why are you holding me like this? So material world is technically slightly not impersonal, but the material energy acts according to our attachment. If we're attached, then it acts in a very complex way to increase our attachment. And similarly, if we are attached to Krishna, then the spiritual energy acts in a very wonderful way to increase our attachment. So living entity means marginal, tatishta, shakti, means that just like the beach is sometimes covered with water, sometimes it's dry land. You can't say the beach is land and you can't say it's water. But on the marginal perimeter, on that marginal position, we can become attached to Krishna. So we have to accept everything favorable for that attachment to Krishna, or we can become attached to the material world, which makes it unfavorable for Krishna consciousness. So that marginal thing is there in our consciousness. We can see it at every moment. At every moment we have a choice to forget Krishna or to remember Krishna. And usually we choose the one to forget Krishna. Whatever reason, it's a nature we choose. We must, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, accept everything favorable for remembering Krishna. That is the only regulated principle of spiritual life, is that one should accept everything favorable, and the negative side is one must reject everything unfavorable. That is real renunciation. Okay. So anyway, I'll finish up. I know you like to hear stories of Prabhupada. So I'll tell a few. But what I'd like to, I'll finish up quickly though. But I'd like to try and explain that the mood in the early days, because there's slightly, obviously 25, 28, 30 years later, I think it's about 30 years later, there's a difference in moods with the movement. When we first joined, when I first came in touch with the devotees, the whole emphasis of the movement was to glorify Krishna. And that was because Prabhupada directly instigated that. He set the movement up in such a way. I'll give you an example. We got up in the morning, and all of us went, you know, Mangalari. Then we chanted japa in the temple room. And everyone who knows in those days, that was the most ecstatic japa period. The devotees used to literally be bouncing off the wall. I don't know why, but it was very ecstatic. And we all remember that. Then we had our morning class. Then after class, we had our breakfast. Then we did about half an hour cleaning, 1 hour cleaning or something, and then we went out, which used to be about 10:30, right through to 5 o'clock on Hari Nam. Every day. There wasn't a day except Sunday that we stopped. So we used to even bring the prasadam out on the street. And we would take prasadam in the park. And then we come back. So usually we used to get it back about 5:30. Now, if you just join the movement, which I had, and Haribu, you know, next thing you're out on the street for 8 hours. It's quite intense. Because normally you think, you know, go out for an hour and you think, you know, wow, this is intense. But it was like, and in those days, remember, there was very few devotees. It's not that it was this big, wild kirtans. It was actually sometimes. I mean, one guy bumped into me, and he'd become a devotee. And he said to me, hey, he said, you know, he said, I remember you from Bury Place. And I hadn't remembered it. But since he'd gone to another temple, but he'd become a devotee. And this was very recently, actually, not so long ago. I think about 6 months ago or something, I bumped into him. So he said, yeah, he said, you were the first guy I met. and now this is now 28 years later or something. I said, really? Yeah. He said, yeah, you're walking around about 10 o'clock at night in Piccadilly doing Harinam on your own. So I said, oh, yeah, I remember, because sometimes it turned out that there was usually, we had a thing in those days that there was, we were also kind of, because we were on the Apple label, so we used to go and do these programs sometimes. And sometimes the devotees were away doing programs. So I remember we used to go out, sing alone on Saturday night, doing Harinam Piccadilly. I did it many, many times. And another devotee, at least there used to be two or three of us, but at least there'd be one. But sometimes there was also 20 or 30 devotees. It depends on the occasion. So he was actually, he said, you know, he said, I was so impressed, he said. I said, I was walking down, he was telling me the story, he said, I was walking down Piccadilly just about to go to the movies or something. He said, I saw this guy coming along. And he looked like jumping up and down, playing these things. He said he looked completely oblivious to what was going on. And he thought to himself, he said, there must be something in this. So that's how he came to the temple. And funny enough, he didn't stay long. Then he went off and he went to another temple because he was just visiting England anyway. But the point was is that was our program. We went out, and all day long we did kirtan. All day long. And then we came back at night. Now listen to this. And this is true. I'm sitting in front of Guru Maharaj. I can't tell lies. We would take prasadam. We would come back and take prasadam. Then we'd have the evening aarti, which generally went on for quite a while. And then we went out in Harinam again. And we used to stay out. Of course, later on, that got a bit risky because we used to stay out till 10. 10:30, 11. Sometimes we got chased by drunks and everything. And we started getting arrested quite regularly. Actually, you'll see in some of Prabhupada's conversations, he talks about devotees getting arrested every day in London. And that was because I reported to him about it. He asked me in this room, not in this room, in the very place. He said, so how are things? Because I was actually temple president at 18. I was 18 years of age. And this is another amazing thing, how things worked in ISKCON. There was no, at that time, there was no GBC even. There was no management structure or anything. There was just this continuous Harinam. And as a result, everything seemed to go on. Literally, there was no collection. We didn't have books. All we used to do is we'd go out with sticks of incense and a conch shell. And we'd walk up to people and give them a stick of incense. We had a thing we had a thing where we had to let the people smell the incense because they didn't know what it was. So we used to rub it under the nose. And it used to leave a black mark. And then the devotees used to kind of get an excitement out of that because they go like that and they'd be like, this black mark. And the person would go walking off down the road with a mustache. So we had this sticks of incense in our conch shell. And I remember our collection was, you know, literally 30p, 40. I remember I did the biggest ones and it was £2. That was a full day on the street. But we had these Harinams and they were very, very static. Everyone went in Harinam. Everyone who came just went. And honestly, there was a fight to get out. Now, this is going out every day of the week. There was a fight to get out. Now, in those days, we shared everything. I mean, it was kind of hard to explain. I don't know why, but we shared everything, including the toothpaste, the toothbrush, everything. Whatever was there. We had this toothpaste. Someone got this brilliant. It was kind of funny in the early days because we always used to get these things Prabhupada said. So someone got this thing that Prabhupada said you should have toothpaste made of mustard oil and salt. Now, I don't know if you know mustard oil. It's very, very hot. So this devotee would get a bottle of mustard oil. Any other toothpaste was Maya, it was demonic, it was everything. But this toothpaste was bona fide. So he'd have this big bowl of salt and a bottle of mustard, which a devotee would add regularly. And people would stick their toothbrush in. So you had all these promises. And they all, and everyone would be going, ah. And you had this kind of, you had this burning in your mouth the whole morning. And we used to share all the clothes as well. And in those days, we had some really spaced out bhaktas. I mean, if you saw them, you couldn't believe them. But there were some real spaced out guys. So they used to just put everything in the machine, and it used to tangle in these huge knots. Because I don't know if you've ever put about 50 dhotis in a machine. But when you pull them out, it's just this big, huge knot. And that used to get chucked in the dryer. And when we come back, we used to have a tea chest. You know, those wooden tea chests. I haven't seen them around so much, but they were for carrying tea. We had one of those, and we put all the clothes in there. So everyone would come along and undo this knot, and that was your clothes. And the bedding was kept in one cupboard, and everyone would share the bedding. So if you're late to bed, you didn't get any bedding. And it was these few blankets. We were extremely poor. I mean, you can't imagine. It's hard to imagine, but our food all came from donations. Everything we ate came from donations. We used to go to the market. And it literally, I remember on several occasions, there was no question of having socks. That was like, you know, luxurious if you had some socks. But if you had some shoes, it was pretty good. Because we used to share, everyone used to just grab shoes to go in Harinam. So on several occasions, many occasions, we'd have people in Harinam in bare feet. And people would buy shoes for them. We were really scruffy. We had these dhotis, because we never had dhotis from India at that time. No one had, we didn't even, you know to get dhotis from India. We used to buy locally. And the material, everyone was into this bright saffron, because we were all Brahmacharis, most Brahmachari, Brahmacharini predominantly. So we bought this, you know, bolt, because we used to get these Indian people to give us the cheapest nylon that you could buy. But it was bright orange. But I don't know if you know nylon, when you wash it, it becomes electrified. It's like, so when you used to pull it out of the dryer, it used to get almost electrocuted. And then when we would wear it, after you washed it about 100 times, because you're not supposed to put nylon through a machine every day and dry, the dhoti would become like a, it was almost like a creepy fungus that was, it would climb up your leg. You know, it was so sort of like plastified or plastic. So we go out in the middle of winter with these nylon dhotis. In the pouring rain. The other thing we had was we'd never stop even if it was raining. We had this thing. Because Oxford Street doesn't have a lot of protection. Now, if you're going out every day of the week and it's raining, we used to just go out raining. So now and again we take shelter. A lot of times we just carry on. Where Lord Chaitanya's moving, Harry Bowl. And we go through. So snow, rain, everything. But the main thing was, and this is something which was really very, very important, was that the whole temple was actually static. It was electrified with the holy name. And even in the sleep, devotees used to chant. I saw many times devotees would be lying there going, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Because they'd be completely immersed in the chanting. So that's how basically the Prabhupada set up the movement. There was no meetings or management or discussions about what we're going to do. We just simply went out on Kirtan Harinam, and then every now and again a devotee would say, oh, I'm off to Italy to open the temple. Someone would go off to Amsterdam. I went off to Scotland. And I remember when I went to Scotland, it was like a thing where no one had said, go to Scotland, but I just heard that Prabhupada was educated by a teacher. Tananjaya got a letter, and Prabhupada was explaining about his teacher was from Edinburgh. So I thought, and Prabhupada said in it, you are also Scottish from Edinburgh, you should preach in Edinburgh. So Dhananjaya was off to Italy or something, Amsterdam or something. So I thought, well, let me go to Edinburgh. So I took one devotee, Kishore, and we went up there. And we went around knocking on people's houses. And when they'd open the door, we'd say, can we stay with you? Now, we were clean shaven with this nylon dhotis and curl. I don't know what we looked like. with this fried tilak. Now, people in those days didn't know the Hare Krishna movement, and definitely not in Scotland. So we usually got this look like, not only can you not stay with us, but what the heck are you doing at my door? But we didn't know anything else to do, because we went up there with we had a few pounds. I think we had 2 pounds, 3 pounds. Now, to start a temple with 2 or 3 pounds is not easy. And we didn't know how we were going to do it anyway. So we came to this one door, and we knocked, and this guy opened the door. And he was an old Polish refugee from the war, but he'd been living with his wife there. And his wife had died in a room upstairs. He'd never gone in it since, which was years earlier. So, funny enough, the guy was so lonely, I think he was happy that anyone even knocked on his door. And I think he took pity on us, because it was late at night, and it was particularly cold. When we went up there, it was freezing. And he said, well, I have a room upstairs. He said, you could stay there. And we then pointed out, we were very grateful. We pointed out that we had very little money. So he said, well, it's all right. He said, you can pay me whatever you can afford. I think we worked it out, £3 a week or something, £4 a week. But anyway, we stayed there. Now, this room had a double bed. And it was about the size of, probably about the size of Prabhupada's bathroom. It wasn't a big room. It wasn't a big house. It had this big double bed in it. And it had a gas ring for a gas fire, which later on, we got a gas ring that we used to cook on. We used to connect it to the fire thing. And that was our kitchen. So we had that for cooking on. We had a double bed in the room, which took up most of the room, and that's where we lived for about 8 months. And every day we went out in Harinam, every single day, and we used to bring guests back to the room. Now, it was way out of the city center, but not only that, when people would come in, they'd have to sit the other side of the double bed. So all of our conversations on philosophy was across the double bed, which is most unusual. And I think people were pretty bewildered when they came in. But anyway, that's how we conducted our temple. And when I was out one day, I was looking around. There's this big building. It was a market. It was a hippie market. But it was huge. And I noticed that the top part of it had all these gargoyles, and it was a real Gothic type of building. But it was empty. So I thought, wow, that's empty. That's unbelievable. Right in the heart of the town. Such a big place is empty. What I didn't know is that building was used by Aleister Crowley for his black magic and all of his witchcraft. So that's probably why it was empty, but I didn't know at the time. So anyway, I went to the, I found from the city records, town council records, who owned the building. I went to them. They were an insurer. It was a solicitor acting on behalf of someone who I've never met to this day. But they couldn't rent it. That's where I came to the conclusion now, looking back. They couldn't rent it to anyone. So they were very happy that someone would take care of it, because they were worried about a fire, because the market people were keeping all their rubbish on these floors above it. So he gave me the building. And I, at that time, also had no money, because our bank account wasn't existing. I said to him when he agreed to let us rent it, I said, there is one problem, and I said, is we have no money. We're monks. But we've been sent there by our Guru Maharaj. He wanted a temple in Edinburgh, so I've come to do that. So I think the guy just took so much pity. I mean, here's an 18-year-old kid, or 19, trying to start a center for some guru, and it's like he hasn't got a hope in hell. So he gave me the place for, I think it was £12 a week. This huge building, it was 3 floors. The temple room was this. It was about it was nearly the size of the temple room downstairs. It was a big temple. It was about 3/4 that size. Anyway, you could get 200 people in there or something like that. It was a big temple room. And it had a lot of rooms. And there was me and this one other brahmachari. And we suddenly had a temple. Whereas we were living in a little room with a bed. And we'd made a couple of devotees, although they were very shaky. But we were hanging on to them. So What happened was that I got the building and I wrote to Shamsunder. So Shamsunder read the letter to Prabhupada while Prabhupada was having a massage in Bombay, and Prabhupada became very ecstatic and very pleased. Shamsunder wrote me back, and Prabhupada is very pleased that you have gotten the temple. And Prabhupada actually wrote me a letter also, a very nice letter, 2-page letter, which is very unusual to get a very long letter. Prabhupada talked about his childhood in that letter, and it was a very, very sweet letter. So anyway, I went down when Prabhupada arrived on one of his regular visits coming through London, and we're on a morning walk. So then Prabhupada said to me, "Oh, so Tribhuvanath, you have temple?" And this is another thing to understand, that Prabhupada was extremely personal. He always called even his disciples, he knew their names, all of them. I mean, not every single one, but whenever I saw Prabhupada, always remembered names. But he always used to call by my name in a very extremely courteous way. Prabhupada was a gentleman. He was gentle, saintly, all good qualities decorated his body and his heart. And Prabhupada was always very extremely humble. I mean, I've seen it over the years, people try to somehow imitate Prabhupada. No one could ever imitate Prabhupada because Prabhupada was unlimitedly deep, very deep, but always full of love. So Prabhupada said, "So Tribhuvanath," in a loving way, he said, "So you have temple, Edinburgh?" And I said, "Yes, Prabhupada, we have our temple." Prabhupada said, "So I am coming." So I was shocked. I said, "Prabhupada, you come to Edinburgh?" If you look at how many temples Prabhupada visited, actually, there's a lot of big, big temples Prabhupada didn't visit. But Prabhupada wanted to come. Now that presented a difficulty because we had this big building with about, I don't know, 20 rooms or something, big rooms, and we had nothing, no money or nothing. So immediately I was ecstatic. I said, "Oh, Prabhupada, that would be wonderful." I said, "But Prabhupada, the only thing is we have no arrangement there." Prabhupada said, "Do not worry. I will come." So I had to then get everything ready, and Prabhupada was coming within about a week. So we had one really far out devotee, Charanaravindam, who was he was like one of these really, you know, bizarre hippies who liked to paint everything in a hippie fashion. So he went up there and he splattered the place with paint. In the shower room he painted the Himalayan mountains, took away the shower faucet and put a hole. So when you turn the tap on, the water came out the wall. And it was like a waterfall from the Himalayas. I'm pretty sure it was cold water as well. In Scotland, water gets really cold. And then we painted all, you know, it was like real Indian type of painting. But anyway, so Prabhupada's room was a difficulty because we had nothing to put in there. And it shows you how poor we were because we went down to one market and begged an old kitchen table, which was a big table, but it was ugly as anything. We painted it a sort of fluorescent green or something. You know, it's just an ugly old green color. I think we got some cheap paint. So we painted it up and we cut the legs off. So it was about that high off the ground, but it was massive. And then we managed to get an old bed, which you fold up. You know, one of those things you get? So we got one of those. So we thought that would be, you know, Prabhupada's bed. And I think the other thing we had was, a one-bar electric fire. Now, that building was freezing, but we had no other means of heating it. So we bought this fire for Prabhupada. And that was it. We painted the room, the floor, the ceiling, and the walls, all the same color. And put a bit of mat down. So if you walked in there, it looked like something out of some sort of really a kind of hippie thing, you know, where it's like just half-baked anyway. And the other problem was we hadn't finished the toilet because we were trying to do everything before Prabhupada, by the time Prabhupada got there. We didn't manage to do that. So there was no bathroom on that floor. That meant Prabhupada had to go to the top floor. And Prabhupada was actually sick at the time. So that, therefore, what we had to do was put a bowl in the next room for Prabhupada to use as a urinal. So you can imagine how inconvenient that was to Prabhupada. Now here we're talking about such a powerful, at that time the movement was also becoming very powerful. And here was a great spiritual master, Mahabhagwat. Prabhupada never complained once about anything. I never heard one single complaint. And Prabhupada was very, very, very concerned that all the devotees had been looked after. He was very ecstatic. He gave a wonderful class. We had kirtan. And then he called me up to his room. Now, everything was wrong in the building. Everything was wrong. I mean, you know, if I looked at faults, they were all over the place. And Prabhupada called me in his room, and in a very nice way, Prabhupada asked about the building and about the people across the road. We had a group called the Divine Light across the road. They were right across the road. And Prabhupada had noticed them out of his window, so he asked about them. We used to call him Guru Miraj. He was the Guru Maharaji. So anyway, Prabhupada asked about him for a while, and he asked about the devotees. And at first, actually, when I went in his room, went and sat in Prabhupada's room, and I was completely, you know, I was actually pretty out of it, to be honest. Because before Prabhupada came, I used to drive around a scooter. I had a scooter. That was the only, because none of us had a car license, and we couldn't afford a car anyway. So I used to drive all over the country in a scooter. So I'd gone down to Newcastle from Edinburgh to deliver an order of incense. Just to get a bit of money. So I'd gone down there, and I arrived there, and it turned out the shop was closed. That was on the Saturday night. It was Saturday. Friday I arrived there. That's right. I arrived there Friday. It closed. So I had to wait all night Saturday, and Prabhupada was coming that evening. So I had to get back up to, I slept in the sidecar that night, and then I had to drive all the way back up to Edinburgh. Luckily, the devotees there, Vivekananda was there, but Jayari went out and hired a big limousine to pick Prabhupada up, which was very nice. We never actually paid for it. Anyway, it was a very nice reception. So Prabhupada also had a very nice reception when he arrived. But I literally came around the corner as Prabhupada was arriving in my little scooter. And I came up, I quickly showered, came down, and then that's when Prabhupada called me to the room. So I was, you know, I imagine driving 200 miles on a scooter, you know. My consciousness. So I sat down there in front of Prabhupada, sort of completely splayed out. And Prabhupada, this desk was so good. So Prabhupada was leaning on the desk like that, and it was so high. And Prabhupada was in his scooter. So Prabhupada was like that. And then I was the other side of the sticky desk. And then Prabhupada went like this. And he was showing me how he couldn't reach anything. Because his desk was like this. So Prabhupada moved his arm and he said, "My arms are so long." I said, "Oh, Krishna." I just said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Prabhupada. I felt so bad. So I'm sorry. We don't have any money. I couldn't get anything. This is all I could get you." Prabhupada said, he was actually very happy. He said, "Actually, I'm very pleased." He said, "It's a very nice temple. Krishna has been very kind to you." And then he started talking about Edinburgh, how that was where his teachers were from. So next morning, we went on a morning walk, and Prabhupada was telling us a little bit about his when he was at school with these Scottish teachers. They were very principled people, the Scottish missionaries, and Prabhupada liked that. They were also philosophically inclined. So we had some nice talks, and we took Prabhupada around the Edinburgh Castle, and Prabhupada stood up there on the, what do you call those things where they shoot the arrows from? It was kind of, Yeah, rampart. So Prabhupada was standing up there looking over Edinburgh. And he looked so serene. When you were with Prabhupada, it was like being with a king, to give an example. But Prabhupada had a majestic aristocracy that is hard to describe. And everything Prabhupada looked at was very intent. He would notice everything very carefully, but you never knew what he was thinking. That was the beauty of Prabhupada. So I was a little bit kind of intrigued what Prabhupada was thinking. So anyway, I was standing next to Srila Prabhupada, and then Prabhupada turned to me and said, "Just see." And I was looking at him. Prabhupada was talking very kind. He said, "Just see." And as I looked down, I could see what Prabhupada, but Prabhupada said, "They're simply attached to their monument." So much attached simply to their monument. So Prabhupada was, you know, for most people to look over the castle of Edinburgh, to look down on the town, it was actually very picturesque, all these beautiful monuments and this and that. But Prabhupada was disgusted. Just see how attached they are. So that's how you could never predict what Prabhupada was going to say. And then Prabhupada started talking about how the materialist is so much attached to the big concrete, you know, these monuments, and they want to show, they want to create something solid. The basic theme was, the Prabhupada said, everyone's trying to create something very solid in the material world, even though it's transitory. So anyway, I'll quickly finish up. But basically, we got back to the temple, and Prabhupada, he had to share the shower with us. Actually, what would happen is we'd go to a bath down the road, but every now and again, we'd sneak into the shower, thinking that it wasn't Prabhupada's time. So I went in there and had a shower. But Prabhupada, there was a knock on the door, and sure enough, Nanda Kumar said, "Prabhupada, it's Prabhupada." Well, I didn't know what to do. Here I was all soaked up in the shower, and Prabhupada's waiting at the door. So I just literally leapt out, put a towel around, and just ran out of the bathroom. What I didn't know was Prabhupada was standing right outside the door. So it was a very small hallway. So I actually, next minute I was looking at Prabhupada and he was looking at me, and I was all this dripping soap, suds. So then the next stupid thing was I paid my basement fee. And of course, all the suds went all over Prabhupada's dhoti, on his shoes. And I was sort of lying there, blocking Prabhupada going into the shower room and covered in soap. And as I got up, I looked again at Prabhupada, and he was simply smiling. He was just thinking, "Just see this fool." There was no logic in my behavior. But Prabhupada was so kind, so Prabhupada called me in. Now, it was always very rare to kind of get to do intimate things with Prabhupada, but this was very intimate because Prabhupada was going to have a shower. So he only had a gumshoe on, and he was shaving. He was starting to shave. So I was actually getting ready, but I was taking my time because I wanted to watch Prabhupada having a shave. So I looked over. So Nanda Kumar brought out the razor, and he was handing it to Prabhupada. Now, I didn't know at the time, but Prabhupada was very meticulous about everything. But he was particularly meticulous about his own personal items, how he used things. This particular razor, apparently Nanda Kumar explained that he forgot Prabhupada's razor, so he got another one. And Prabhupada started using the razor, and he looked at it like that. And then he looked at Nanda Kumar and he said, "This is Jalak." Now, first of all, that's right. First of all, he had the razor in his hand like that, and he was pointing, "Where's the dial?" Because if you look in that room, you'll see there's a dial on the razor, which adjusts the cutting. So Prabhupada was saying, "Where's dial?" But he didn't say it, he just pointed at Nanda Kumar. Nanda Kumar could understand. So he said, "No." He said, "Prabhupada, that's not Gillette." So first of all, Prabhupada said, "This is Gillette." Then he pointed to the dial. And then Nanda Kumar said, "No, Prabhupada, this is not Gillette." And Prabhupada went, "Simply bogus." And it was so wonderful, because all of this was very intense. It was like, everything Prabhupada did had some sort of majestic intensity. There was lessons galore to be learned. But basically, it looked like it was almost like Prabhupada was in class dismissing the entire Mayavadi philosophy. He just dismissed this razor, and he just there was a shelf there, and he just gently sort of flung it on that shelf. But he just said, simply bogus. And I was fascinated. And anyway, we had to run off and get Prabhupada a dial razor right away. So I rushed off to do that. But again, I'm going to quickly finish this. I could talk all night, but it's one of those things. But anyway, basically, we took Prabhupada to a program, and Prabhupada liked trains, because in England the trains were good, and also it was very comfortable. So anyway, Prabhupada went by train. We had a big festival that night. We put out advertisements and had a picture of the globe, the planet, and had Prabhupada's face in the middle of the planet. And it was not just face, but Prabhupada's body, but it said, world leader Hare Krishna movement comes to Glasgow. And we plastered the town. So the hall was packed. And Prabhupada gave a very wonderful lecture. It was very wonderful. I could tell a whole story about that. And we had a big rousing kirtan. But what we forgot was we had no prasadam for Prabhupada. Now, because I was organizing the whole program and we had no money, I actually had to collect the money when people were coming in to go and book Prabhupada's room at the airport because he was leaving that night. So as people were coming in, I was going up to him saying, could you help out because our guru has come, but we have no money to get him a room and he's leaving tonight, we need to get him a hotel room. So I collected the money. Now I had to do all this while I was actually setting up the program and everything else. And then I had to go to the airport and book the room, pay for it and everything, and then come back and do the program. So there was a lot of senior devotees there, so the program went on. But anyway, at the end of the program, we had no prasadam. And some devotee came to me and said, where's Prabhupada's prasadam? And I was flabbergasted. I realized I didn't have any prasadam and no one else had brought prasadam. So that means Prabhupada hadn't eaten the whole day. And I don't know what he had for breakfast. He used to eat a very light breakfast. So what I did was cut up all these oranges. Our feast. We had a feast for the festival. It was oranges. And Prabhupada must have asked for some of the feast, which was oranges. So we brought Prabhupada lots of oranges. I think it was about 15 oranges. So we chopped them all up and we brought them into Prabhupada, and Prabhupada sat there very elegantly eating these oranges. Again, he never complained. He just ate the oranges. And so then what happened was that it was time for Prabhupada to go and I had to take him to the hotel. So with his servant and one other servant, we were leaving. All the other devotees were, it was like this was a special room behind where the artists get changed or something. So it was just really Prabhupada's servant and me. So I went out and I opened the door for Prabhupada. And as you open the door, you step down a little bit. So as Prabhupada came out, then I remember till this time, I'll never forget that, but as Prabhupada was coming down the hallway, Prabhupada looked completely intoxicated with love of God. It was like that. It describes a little bit how Lord Nityananda has a certain gait when he walks. So Prabhupada had this certain gate. It was very ecstatic anyway. And I could see that Prabhupada was actually in a very transcendental ecstasy. And then when he reached the door, Prabhupada looked over at me, and we were very close because as I opened the door, Prabhupada came out. So then he just took both his hands and put them on my head, and he started rubbing my head. And I was just bewildered. I didn't know what was going on. And at this time, of course, Prabhupada was about maybe the same height as me. So we were both sort of face to face. And then Prabhupada said, I am very, very pleased with what you have done. He said, so now carry on this all over. And I'm not sure if Prabhupada said all over UK, but he said all over. And then Prabhupada just gave a very beautiful smile. And then he went down the steps. And then we got in this beaten old Sankirtan van because the limousine had gone and we had no money. So we had an old beaten up Sankirtan van, which was also used for vegetable collection and everything else. So Prabhupada got in the front and I was driving. So Prabhupada was sitting there in the front, there was me and a bunch of devotees behind, all sticking their head over, waiting for Prabhupada what he was going to say. The father just talked about the program, how he enjoyed it. And then there was these really scruffy kids, I mean really dirty street kids. They came to the program and they were dancing like anything at the end kirtan. And Prabhupada seemed to be giving them incredible attention. You could tell he was encouraging them and really like that. So Prabhupada was talking about the program. Then Dhananjaya said, yeah, but those kids, Prabhupada, they were kind of creating a disturbance for Dhananjaya anyway. So he mentioned the Prabhupada. They were a bit of a nuisance, I think he said, or something like that. And Prabhupada said, no, they are devotees. Somehow they had a relationship with Prabhupada. That's what I felt from it. They were devotees. And this was their contact with Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was he was quite strong about it. He said, no, no, they are devotees. And then Anjali said, yeah, but they were very dirty, Prabhupada. That is their parents. So it's like Dhananjaya was criticizing a devotee and Prabhupada was chastising him. And so anyway, cut a long story short, we got to the airport, the airport hotel, and then we went into the sort of reception where you check in. So you never usually sit with your Guru Maharaj. You always sit on the floor. But I had to talk to Prabhupada, so I sat right next to Prabhupada. So I said, Srila Prabhupada, because at this time I was feeling terrible that Prabhupada hadn't eaten. So I said, can I get you anything to eat? He said, oh, you can get. So then I thought to myself, yeah. You know, in my mind I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to get some. Even if I have to go down to the kitchen, cook it myself, or whatever. So I said, yeah, I can get you, Prabhupada. He said, oh, what can you get? So I said, oh, I'm going to get you vegetables. Would you like, Prabhupada, vegetables? So I said, yes, that would be nice. And rice and vegetables. So I was saying these different things, and Prabhupada was going, yes, yes, yes. So I went off, and then I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to take on this hotel. They're going to cook there. Let me cook for Prabhupada. I'm going to get him some prasadam. So my GBC was Shyam Sundar at that time, and also a very close friend. So I went up to Shyam Sundar. I said, Prabhupada's hungry and we've got to get him prasadam. Shyam Sundar, what are you going to get Prabhupada? I said, I'm going to cook him some vegetables. I just talked to Prabhupada. He wants vegetables, he wants rice, and we're going to do it. He said, you can't do that in a hotel. They're not going to let you go in the kitchen. I said, oh, they will. I'll ask them. He said, no, no, no. He said, well, use room service. So anyway, yeah, my cooking went out the window. So I took Prabhupada up to the room, and we ordered room service. Oh, no, that was right. While I was sitting with Prabhupada, I forgot that. I said to Prabhupada, what would you like? And then Prabhupada, obviously, I hadn't been to hotels many times, knew there wasn't a great selection. You're limited. You can only get a limited amount of a thing, isn't it? No matter what you try to get. In your hand, how much can you hold? Isn't it? Try and hold more than you can hold and it falls off your hand. In your eyes, how much can you grasp? You can never see more than one part of what you're seeing. Just like I'm sitting in this room, 50% of it is cut off. So how can I talk about what's behind me? And even I can't talk about what's behind me and I'm sitting in the exact place. So, therefore, when there's limited, then there's adjustment. Because you have to make adjustment. I have to move my head. Oh, I saw someone. I didn't see him. Now I see him. You see? So I have to make adjustment. So, in that sense, because we're in the limited world and everything is limited, we sometimes think that Guru is also limited. You see, this is our nature, that there may be some limited aspect to Guru. There is no limited aspect. Just like I was in a room with Srila Prabhupada and we were discussing this topic. So one newspaper reporter had come with some other newspaper reporters and they were big, big newspapers. There was the Times, the Daily Mirror, there was the Telegraph, there was a few. There was about 20 reporters in the room in Bury Place. So Prabhupada, it was very ecstatic to watch Prabhupada when he dealt with people. Prabhupada had an amazing psychology. It was, you can't even describe it, because he never ever was victimized by anyone. In the material world, everyone is victimized. Actually, we're all victims. Because a victim means someone who may be overcome by more powerful thing, isn't it? That's what a victim is in a sort of general term. So I always used to think with reporters, of course, you had to behave in a certain way and everything else. But Prabhupada was hilarious because he was so direct, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. And yet, the people who he was direct with were actually always very respectful because they knew that he was speaking the truth. He never tried to make any kind of, adjustment to the situation to be more acceptable or non-acceptable. Just like in Amsterdam when Prabhupada was doing the installation of Jagannath deities, then there was all these cameras there. There was about 2 television stations. And there was all sorts of reporters. But anyway, the devotees had made a complete mess up of the installation, including the fact that they had no items for the fire sacrifice. Now, Prabhupada actually was disturbed. He was visibly disturbed at this negligence. Oh, no. Huh? Really? I didn't know. Well, I always take the shower with that.